Welcome back to Issues Etc. In this last hour, Paul Copan joins us. We'll talk about religious discrimination on campus, and then we'll have open lines for your questions and your comments. A very nice email to share with you. We don't do this very often, but this one fits so nicely with our conversation yesterday during open lines. I think it's a good idea to share it with the rest of the audience as well, having to do with fads in the church. Paul Copan teaches philosophy at Georgia Perimeter College. He is author of several books, including his latest titled The Rationality of Theism, and he's also written an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Christophobia, Confronting the Problem of Religious Discrimination on Campus. Paul, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be back.
What do you mean by this term, Christophobia?
Well, it seems that Christianity tends to be singled out as the object of derision and scorn, the narrow, arrogant, bigoted view, and it seems that anything else goes. The only heresy that exists, say, on university campuses today is Orthodox Christianity. You can be a Buddhist, you can be a Hindu, you can be a Muslim, and so forth, but the Christian seems to be singled out for censure because that person's a Christian. And so that is what I'm talking about, that this, the Christian viewpoint seems to be singled out as, irrational, as intolerant, and so forth. And what I try to do in the article is to show how we all have differing beliefs, and therefore we need to argue for which makes the best sense out of the way things are.
Why is it that the Christian viewpoint is, as you say, singled out on the campus?
Well, I think probably historically speaking, Christianity has, in its abusive form, Inquisition, Crusades, and so forth, there has been a lot done in the name of Christ that has been oppressive and wrong and so forth. And I think that there is this kind of connotation that Christianity equals oppression. And secondly, I think, too, that there seems to be some idea that is prevalent with regard to Christianity that, it's been tried. We've tried it in Western civilization, and we need to move on to something else. The idea that Jesus is the only way, that's kind of passé. We're into the pluralistic age now. We need a Copernican revolution, as the pluralist John Hicks said, where we're moving beyond Christianity as being at the center and seeing this ultimate reality at the center and all these religions, including Christianity, kind of revolving around it like the planets orbit the sun. And I think that those are a couple of components as to why Christianity, is in a sense taking a beating. It doesn't, of course, doesn't help that there are people who, today can be perhaps brash, well-meaning people, of course, who are Christians, but yet just telling people, just believe, or pigeonholing them, backing them into a corner with their evangelistic zeal, but yet not with a lot of wisdom intact.
Okay, as a matter of principle, I'm trying to gauge my own reaction to this. As a matter of principle, I don't mind if Christians are being singled out anywhere in our culture as long as it's for the right reasons.
Exactly.
And so as a matter of principle, I'm a little irked that in the name of academic and freedom of thought and speech, this kind of stuff can take place.
Right.
Is it Christianity itself that is being singled out, or is it a caricature of Christianity?
Well, I'd say it's probably a combination of both. You're right to point out that a lot of times people are reacting to not what really the gospel message is, but to a caricature of it, people whose characters do not match up to the message that they're proclaiming. Jesus said, blessed are you who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people think that they're being persecuted for the sake of righteousness when it's actually for the sake of their foolishness or their arrogance or something that they're being persecuted. And so we do need to make a distinction there. I think you're right in pointing out, though, that some people have a particular association with Christianity as being, when they think of Christianity, they think of crusades, they think of oppression, they think of, slavery, I think, or a wrong connotation there. But again, there have been so many things done in the name of Christianity that people just assimilate the caricature and can't differentiate between the real and the counterfeit. But on the other hand, there just is, it doesn't matter how, intellectually, well-defended Christianity is in the minds of some people, they will just not allow it as a legitimate part of the discourse in the marketplace of ideas on university campuses. There is often this hostility coming from naturalists, people who hold to the idea that the natural realm is all that there is, that everything could be explained in terms of the spatio-temporal world and the cause and effect processes that take place within it. So you do have that, and also just relativists who hold to whatever's true is for you is true for you, and whatever's true for me is true for me. And when you have Christianity, making the claim that, well, this is true for everyone, there is going to be a kind of resistance there. The philosopher John Searle, who's an atheist at Berkeley, said that people are relativists and anti-realists. They, whatever is real for you is real for you, and whatever is real for me is real for me. You could create your own reality. People like that, he said, basically, and again, it's not an argument against their position, but he said that their motivation is that they don't want reality cramping their style. They don't want something infringing upon their freedom. And I think that this is part of our cultural ethos, where there's something that claims to be authoritative and so forth, there's going to be this natural resistance toward it.
Does the same indignation of the academy prevail on campus for other major world religions outside of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, you name it?
Well, I would say that Islam perhaps might have run a close second in some ways, just because of its own history and the militaristic aggression that is basically was there from the start with Muhammad, its founder. So in that regard, people do recognize certain exclusivistic claims on the part of Muslims. But I think, given what's happened in the wake of the September 11th attacks, I think there's just been a knee-jerk reaction, kind of a pendulum swing toward the other side, where we don't want to say anything negative about Islam. We don't want to to say anything about Islam's history, about maybe negative things about during the founding of Islam and so forth. And so things are just kept quiet, and so there's no real open discourse that may mention any negatives pertaining to Islam. And I think that there is this an unnecessary sensitivity to Islam, which in a sense shoves under the rug a lot of issues that need to be dealt with, that are there's a caricature of Islam that is being put forward, I think, that needs to be seriously discussed. Islam is called a religion of peace, but you look at its history, you look at its writings, both in the Quran as well as in the traditions, the Hadith. You look at the history of Islam throughout the centuries and its militaristic aggression. You look at its very theology, and you see that there is an us-them mentality, that there will not be peace until everyone is in the abode or the realm of Islam. And so jihad, whether it be intellectual struggle or also physical struggle, militaristic struggle, that has been par for the course throughout the history of Islam. So it really is entrenched in the mindset of Islam. So, but with Buddhism, with Hinduism, these tend to be pluralistic and kind of open to all different religions. each religion has its own way. It's like picking out of a smorgasbord your particular flavor, your particular dish that you like. It's whatever your preference is. So, you know, the Dalai Lama speaks in this way, that religion is often a matter of preference, but yet even the Dalai Lama himself denies the existence of a creator God, as within Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. So there is a certain exclusivity to the Buddhist claim, but yet that's kind of papered over, and it's seen as quote tolerant and including all and accepting all religions as equally valid.
Oh, that intrigues me. What is the definition of tolerance on campus today?
Well, the definition of tolerance today on campus, which is a distortion of the historical understanding, is that all views should be accepted as true or valid. That if you are intolerant, it is because you are not accepting another person's view as true. But of course, if you do that, then you can't accept the Buddhist view and the Christian view, because one denies a creator and the other affirms a creator. So you can't logically accept both as true. So you run into real problems if you understand tolerance as being accepting all views as true. The historical definition has been the willingness to put up with what one takes to be erroneous or false. I don't tolerate things that I enjoy. I don't tolerate chocolate, for example. I enjoy chocolate. I tolerate things like somebody snoring in the library. I don't like it; it distracts me from my studying. But yet, I don't have the person evicted or something like that. So tolerance means putting up with what I find disagreeable or false or erroneous, rather than simply accepting all views as true.
We're talking with Paul Copan about religious discrimination on campus. He teaches philosophy at Georgia Perimeter College. He's author of several books, including his latest, The Rationality of Theism, and he's also written an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Christophobia, Confronting the Problem of Religious Discrimination on Campus. How would this true tolerance, then, operate on campus in the best of all possible worlds?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, it would acknowledge that there are genuine and legitimate differences between belief systems. Rather than papering over the differences, it would be an acknowledgement that there are real and significant differences between not just naturalism and theism, but between the various religions themselves, that you can't say that, oh, all these religions are basically the same. Rather, what you need to say is there are differing metaphysical beliefs between the religious traditions, whether it pertains to the afterlife, whether it pertains to the nature of the ultimate reality, is the ultimate reality personal or impersonal, and so forth. So that is one way in which we can, I think, begin to come to terms with this whole question of tolerance, that genuine differences exist, but, on the other hand, we need to affirm a person's right to disagree, that you don't have to toe the party line in order to be respected, to be accepted as a partner in dialogue. And I think what often happens is dialogue is reduced to a lowest common denominator kind of approach to the way that we discuss religion or worldviews, where we all have to agree to a basic definition of God, to a basic definition of salvation, that all roads lead to salvation. And what ends up happening is that the religious distinctives of not just Christianity, but Islam or Judaism or Buddhism, that the religious distinctives within each of these religious traditions ends up being denied because we have this watered-down approach to religious dialogue and to religious truth and so forth. So on the one hand, we admit that there are differences in belief, but on the other hand, we show respect to those people who hold those beliefs. So we need to distinguish between religious beliefs or worldview beliefs and the persons who hold them. We don't have to accept everyone's beliefs, but we can accept the persons who hold them as those who have the image of God within them and who are worthy of respect and who have dignity.
Some would say, and you've mentioned this a bit here, or they may not even come out and say it, they would just practice it, a blending in. If Christians want to enter the marketplace of ideas, they need to be willing to blend in a bit, to blur the edges between Christianity and culture, Christianity and other religions, and to affirm what the rest of pluralistic society seems to be urging upon us, and that is, you know, all roads lead to God. We're really just arguing about nuances, but we're in basic agreement with the Muslim or with the Hindu or the Buddhist as to who God is and how you get there. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would say that a person who makes that kind of watered-down approach is really not arguing in any realistic sort of fashion. What I mean by realistic is this, that they don't believe that religious beliefs have any correspondence to reality, to history, to this being we call God, for example. You know, that basically religion in the minds of such people tends to be reduced to a matter of private opinions that don't reflect the way that things are ultimately. And so when, you know, for example, when you are discussing your favorite flavor ice cream, you don't say you ought to eat Ben and Jerry's New York Super Fudge Chunk. This is the ultimate ice cream, and you know, if you have any, if you have good taste, this is the one that you ought to, be eating. But yet people treat religion in a way that's similar to the taste that we have when it comes to eating. That it's just a matter of personal preference, but ultimately, there is no correspondence to history, to some sort of external reality out there, you know, God, the way that things are, the way that things have been created. There's no such correspondence, and what I think we need to do is call the pluralist call on the pluralist to acknowledge his own assumptions. You see, the pluralist assumes that he has a virtue that the Christian or the Muslim does not have. The pluralist believes that that if you don't accept this view that all religions lead to salvation, then you are in error. You are believing something that is false. But this is logically no different from a religion like Christianity that maintains that if you disagree with the claims of Christ or what Christianity affirms, then at that point you would be in error. So religious pluralism has an exclusivistic position, just as Christianity does. And if you disagree at those points where you disagree, you would be in error. So that needs to be pointed out. I like to use the example of the blind men from Benares, India, who are touching different parts of the elephant. One touches the side and says it's a wall. Another one touches the trunk and says it's a snake. And another one touches the leg and says it's a pillar. And the king of Benares, India, is watching all of this and saying, they don't have the whole picture. He kind of chuckles to himself and recognizes that they don't see the full picture. But yet the pluralist says, oh, these different religionists, the Buddhist, the Christian, the Hindu, and so forth, they don't see things clearly. They're just seeing one part of the elephant. They're just culturally conditioned to see things the way that they do. But the pluralist doesn't assume that same posture about himself. He believes that he's risen above cultural conditioning. He believes that he's not another one of those blind men touching his part of the elephant, but that he is the king looking on at these poor buffoons who are not getting the full picture on what these religions are all about. And so I think it's just a matter of honesty to say, to the pluralist, you are taking a particular position that you claim to be true and corresponding to reality, to the way that things are. And insofar as you do that, you are making a certain exclusivistic claim that if someone disagrees with you, that at that point, that person would be in error. And how is that logically different from Christianity? Now, dealing with pluralism is important in that regard, but we also, I think, need to say, to point out, to build bridges where we can. It doesn't mean that I think Christians often give this impression that if Christianity is true, then other religions are 100% erroneous or false. And a lot of times we lose an audience because we have this kind of an approach, rather than building bridges like the Apostle Paul did when he was at Athens. He looked for areas of common ground where he could affirm, have a kind of common court of appeals, you know, appealing to sources that his audience would take as plausible or authoritative, and use those to his advantage in communicating the gospel. I think similarly, what we need to do is utilize the available data when it comes to, say, the historical Jesus or the arguments for the existence of God, say, from science, the fine-tuning of the universe or the Big Bang or something like that. We have a number of objective, publicly accessible points of data to show that this is not just something that's private, but rather this is publicly accessible, and that if you're looking for evidence for the Christian faith, it is certainly available to anyone who is honestly seeking.
Paul, with only about less than 2 minutes here before we have to go, is this really even possible? It seems as though in the history of the Academy, either Christianity has exercised ascendancy, theology the queen of the sciences, or it, as it is today, become a second-class citizen. Is Christianity a viable, qualified participant in the open marketplace of ideas?
I would say absolutely. Alvin Plantinga, the Christian philosopher who really has led a revolution in philosophy to the point that a high proportion of those who are philosophers in North America are predominantly, a high percentage, I would say, are theists or Christians, more specifically. And this is a remarkable revolution that has taken place in philosophy, although it hasn't, needs to be a filtering effect to the other disciplines and so forth. There has been a remarkable shift that has taken place from, say, the 50s and the 60s, and Christianity is keeping up with, Christian philosophers are keeping up with the best of the philosophers, as the atheist Quentin Smith, a philosopher, has acknowledged. And Alvin Plantinga says that there are three worldviews, this idea of anti-realism, naturalism, and theism, that these are the three competitors today in the university, in academia, and there is plenty of available evidence, in the public domain to show why Christian theism is highly plausible and offers answers where, really, in other areas, we're left without much to go on in terms of being able to put all the pieces together. So I think there is hope, through interaction, through not isolating ourselves from the world, but actually engaging it and showing how Christianity does a better job of answering the basic questions to our origins, to our meaning, to our identity, and so forth, than competitors like naturalism or relativism or anti-realism.
Paul Copan, thank you very much for being our guest. Thanks for writing the article as well.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be with you.
Paul Copan teaches philosophy at Georgia Perimeter College, author of several books, including his latest, The Rationality of Theism. He's written this article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Christophobia, Confronting the Problem of Religious Discrimination on Campus. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for the remainder of the program. We had a lively open lines yesterday, talking about fads that have swept in and out of the church. I was having a hard time yesterday coming up with a list of them. My producer wasn't helping out much either. Then you came to our rescue, and we compiled quite a list of fads, past and present, in the church that have come through, done their damage. Some of them are still with us. Some of them have gone the way of all fads and faded away. When we come back, I'd like to continue that conversation. 1-800-730-2727,
505-7850. Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What does St. Paul mean when he writes to the Colossian Christians, "You have died, and your life is now hid with Christ in God"? What is Paul saying when he says that in Christ all the fullness of the deity dwells in bodily form, and that Christians have come to fullness of life in Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. You can order the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians, 1-800-325-3040.
To the Greeks, the cross was foolishness.
Answers with Ken Ham, a well-known creation evangelist and international Bible speaker. Well, Ken, I understand that when Paul preached to the Greeks, they didn't understand the gospel message at first. What was the problem?
We read in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 23, "But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, but unto the Greeks foolishness." It's fascinating to see the difference between the way the Jews responded to the gospel in Acts 2 compared to the Greeks in Acts 17. You see, the Jews understood the meaning of sin and why they sacrificed animals. They also had the law of Moses and the book of Genesis. They knew that murder, adultery, and so on were sin. But even before Darwin, the Greeks were basically evolutionists. They had no concept of the Creator God of the Scriptures and no understanding of sin. So when Paul preached the message of the cross, they just thought it was foolishness. Paul actually had to start at the very beginning, from Genesis, to lay the foundation of the gospel before the Greeks understood. He also had to show them that their evolutionary ideas were wrong and that there was a Creator God. Many people today increasingly are like the Greeks. They don't understand the gospel because they have no concept of the Creator or of sin, which is why we need to start at the very beginning to explain the gospel.
Many Christians are finding it frustrating to share their faith during these questioning times. Well, Ken Ham provides all sorts of wonderful witnessing tools available on our website, answersradio.com.
Psalm 31 coming up here about a minute and a half. We'll continue with Issues, etc. The final half hour today is Open Lines. AM 850 KFUO weather, clear overnight, 62 the low, partly cloudy tomorrow, a chance of rain tomorrow's high 85, 75 now with sunshine in St. Louis. And traffic westbound 40 between Clayton, Skinker, and Hanley, slow traffic. Westbound 70 between the airport and Cypress, slow traffic. Westbound 270 after Washington Elizabeth, there is an accident that has been cleared, but the traffic is jammed back to West Florissant. Westbound 40, that is, between Long and Route K, heavy traffic. Westbound 70 between Earth City Expressway across the Blanchet Bridge into St. Charles, slow traffic there. Eastbound 40 between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge, heavy traffic. And northbound 55 from Park out to the Poplar Street Bridge, heavy traffic there.
So you've taken a trip down the aisle and you're now Mr. and Mrs. Life couldn't be better, or your new spouse more perfect.
Love you, hon.
But you know, marriage is a long haul, and divorce seems to be everywhere. You want to keep the warm glow you feel now. It's time you discovered Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson. A half hour of sound advice for today's families. Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Thursday on the program, Righteousness in the Old Testament. Dr. Walter A. Meyer III of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest to talk about that concept of the Old Testament. Also, we'll get a religion roundup with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. That's Thursday on Issues, Etc. It's Open Lines. Anything you want to talk about, I'd like to extend the conversation we were having yesterday on fads in the church. It was one of those Open Lines hours where we had to leave some folks off at the end of the hour because there simply was not enough time and we had other things we needed to get to yesterday. We were talking about fads in the church. You walk into your closet. Now, my closet is not this way because I am a pitcher. I throw things away. I routinely am telling my wife, we need to go through the closet and get all these clothes that we're not wearing. If you haven't worn it in a year, you're probably not going to wear it ever again. If it doesn't fit, you're not going to ever be that small again. I say this to myself, not to my wife. I'm not going back. I'm sorry. Unless I get a terminal disease, I'm not going back to my 29-inch waist, which I had when we got married. I am firmly beyond that point of no return. And it ain't going to happen. I can dream about it, but keeping those jeans that I used to fit into 13, 15 years ago is just a dream. But I'm not talking about the size. You walk into your closet, and maybe you're not one of those people who cleans it out on a regular basis. And you've got clothes in there that are maybe 20 years old. And you look at, you're not going to wear those again because they look so hokey. You look and you think to yourself, or maybe you find an old picture of yourself from 20, 30 years ago. You see how you were dressed and you say to yourself, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? My daughter looks at these pictures of me from the early 70s when I was her age. Striped pants. The thing, you know what I thought was the coolest thing I ever wore? And I wore this to church. My mom made us vests that were red crushed velvet on the outside and red satin on the inside, and they were reversible. And we wore them to church with our big, long, tapered collars and our little puka bead. Some people are still wearing these things, our little puka bead chokers and our bell-bottom pants and our platform shoes. We thought we were the edge of fashion. Now, my daughter looks back and she says, that looks kind of funky, Dad. She's not willing to say it looks stupid because those fashions are, you know, almost back. She thinks her dad looks silly. But you think to yourself, what was I thinking? But at the time, that fashion, that fad was just, it just looked so good. I mean, you really thought you looked good. You were styling when you were wearing that stuff. You know, the same is true of fads in the church. When the church opens itself up to the fads that blow in and blow out, they do their damage, they leave their mark, and then they go on their way and are quickly forgotten, the church can similarly go through its closet and look back and say, what were we thinking? At the time, that seemed like a great idea, but my goodness, wasn't that ridiculous? There are a lot of fads in the church's closet still hanging there. Some of them we still wear occasionally. Some of them we wouldn't put back on. We compiled a bit of a list yesterday. Remember the Way Down Workshop? It was just a few years ago, but few and far between are those who are still clinging to this fad. It went its way. This Christian weight loss program that turned out to be Gwen Shamblin's new way of getting saved. What about experiencing God? I still actually came across a church the other day that has a Bible class on experiencing God. I don't know if it was Blackaby's thing or whether or not they just were knocking off the title Promise Keepers. That was mentioned yesterday by one of our listeners. Promise Keepers. Bill McCartney is now in retirement. He's given up on Promise Keepers, for heaven's sakes. The Prayer of Jabez, that's more recent, right? But it wasn't that long ago that this thing was flying off the shelves, this little book, and it was being recommended by every pastor and their dog as the solution to the problems in the church. If we got everybody praying this prayer every day, then our church would turn around. Then the personal lives of our people would turn around. They'd start being blessed by God through this prayer. And everyone's lives would turn around. Now, when was the last time your pastor sent you on your way on Sunday morning saying, oh, and don't forget to pray the prayer of Jabez? If he did that now, you might even snicker. You might even say to pastor, that's yesterday's news. That's played. That's so 2002, you might say, which is the way we've been conditioned to think by fads in the church. Y2K? That's going back a couple years. It was supposed to be the turning point for the church, either the return of Christ or the decade of which the church would rise up and do its thing. And there are others. If you can think of any, feel free to give us a call, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. The most current, of course, is one that you could find by driving down the roads of any major thoroughfare in suburbia America. You go past the Baptist Church, they've got a sign out. It says 40 Days of Purpose. You go a little farther past the Methodist Church, there it is again, 40 Days of Purpose. The Lutheran Church, 40 Days of Purpose. The signs come down after a month or so, and Before you know it, you're driving through another section of town, and they're doing 40 Days of Purpose. Rick Warren's got the book. It's selling like hotcakes. I wonder where that one will be hanging in our closet in a couple years. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. If you've got other fads, if one came to you last night after listening yesterday to Open Lines and you thought to yourself, well, there's one that Wilkin left out, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Yesterday we received this email from a listener, really very sweet. I can only read it in part because the rest of it is so kind and complimentary of the show, it would be self-serving for me to read it in total. This listener writes, I didn't want to call the program on this subject today because I have called too many times, but I did want to tell you that I am praying literally that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which I am rejoining after a long absence, will stay the course and be strong and courageous during this and similar current fads that are blowing in the wind these days. She's talking about 40 Days of Purpose. She writes further, I've been a part of an evangelical experience, and I can tell you that you are correct when you say these fads leave the church hungrier than ever. In my case, she writes, I am literally at the starvation point, which is why I thank God daily that I found your program. There's someone who can attest to the fact that the fads of the church, like junk food, well, I made the comparison yesterday with Chinese food. You eat it, and an hour later you're hungrier than ever. Or that's how the old cliche goes. The fads in the church are very much the same. They leave the church hungering for something more. And of course, what's waiting in the wings for the hungry church? Another fad that will leave them even hungrier. Doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere. And none of these things seem to have the staying power to stick around any longer than a year or two, or actually, to stick around any longer than the publishing houses are willing to push the product. That might have something to do with it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go first to Florissant and talk with Martha. Martha, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I was wondering if you remember something about a 50-day adventure. I don't know how widespread that was in the church.
No, I don't remember that at all.
Okay, it seemed like several churches were doing it, like you said, many different denominations, 50-day adventure. And also, wasn't there something sometime back about the authority thing, and they had seminars, and that the parents were responsible for the children, and the wife for the husband for the wife, and I'm not sure if that was in mainline churches or not. I hate to say the last name because I always get names mixed up. I think it was Gothard or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're talking then about Bill Gothard's, it used to be called the Institute for Basic Youth Conflicts.
Okay.
Which is actually still around.
Oh, that is.
It's one of those perennial fads that kind of plays its way in one circle, and then when it's outstayed its welcome, it finds its way into another circle. And it's been remade several times by Bill Gothard. We've done several shows on Gothard's. It's now called the Institute for, oh, I won't even venture a guess. He's changed the name one more time. Yeah. Martha, thank you very much.
Okay, well, if anybody remembers the 50-day adventure, if they could call in about that.
Sure. 50-day adventure. When was this, Martha? Oh, I'm sorry. Martha's gone already. Well, if anyone remembers that, you know, today we've got 40 Days of Purpose. I finished reading the book today, by the way. Rick Warren's 40 Days of, it's not called 40 Days of Purpose, it's called The Purpose-Driven Life, but it's a part of a design that you would read this chapter by chapter, 40 short chapters, over 40 days, and at the end you will have gone through Rick Warren's entire system of the purpose for your life, and he says it will qualify you to pass the test that God will give you on Judgment Day. See, God's going to give out a test on Judgment Day, and this book is basically like studying for the SAT. You know, they have books that will help you pass the SAT. If you study them diligently, you will improve your score on the SAT. They're proven study methods. And as far as I can tell from Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, that's essentially what he's saying this is. God's going to give you a test on Judgment Day. And this book is, well, fairly well necessary for, it sounds like, even getting past the first couple questions of the test on Judgment Day. But at the very least, it can help you get a better grade with God when all is said and done. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Keith is up next, calling from his car. Keith, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I don't know if this qualifies as a fad, because I still sometimes see them in our classrooms at our school. It's the old paperback Good News for Modern Man. I think it was just limited to the New Testament.
No, it's actually an Old Testament edition, too. Yeah.
Oh, there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And whether or not that is very sound, I don't know if that's similar to the Living Bible translation. And my understanding is that, at least with the Living Bible, that the writer of that admittedly doesn't know Greek or Hebrew.
Well, we actually talked about this several weeks back on Issues Etc. when we were talking about something we'll be talking about tomorrow, which is the Revolve Bible for girls, this Bible zine they're calling it. And I started the conversation during that hour of Open Lines talking about, in my day, it was the Good News for Modern Man. And we actually did a little stick on the news for postmodern man, because it couldn't be good, because there's, in postmodern thinking, there's neither good nor bad, good nor evil. There's just all good. Everything's true. Nothing's false. And so it would be the news for a postmodern man. Well, you know, it's still around. It was something of a crossbreed between a paraphrase and a translation. It was valuable, perhaps, as an entry-level Bible or something like that. Its connection to Living Bible is none at all. They're two completely different ventures, the Living Bible being not even a paraphrase, but more or less one guy's interpretation, which kind of parallels the words of the Bible. I guess that would qualify as a fad. I mean, because you don't find a lot of people walking around with the Good News for Modern Man under their arms anymore. Most people have moved on past that. One of those kind of things you outgrow, which is like fads. Fads, you outgrow them. Maybe that's why they come and go so quickly. David is calling from his car. David, welcome to Issues Etc. David, welcome to Issues Etc. I might have made him wait too long. Adele is up next, calling from Ellisville. Hi, Adele.
I go to a Missouri Synod Lutheran church that is just going to start the Purpose-Driven Life 40-day series.
And what are your thoughts on this, Adele?
Well, I'm just not going to join in it. I just can't see it.
Adele,
and then they want to put me out of the church.
Put you out of the church for not
taking
part in the 40 days of purpose?
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting qualification for remaining in a congregation. Are you certain of that, Adele?
Well, unless I misunderstand the letter, I can go to the church, but I won't be a member anymore, according to the letter. And if I'm not a member, what's the point?
Adele, thank you very much for the call. Adele and the others who have congregations that are getting ready or going through 40 days of purpose, I've given a few thoughts here just briefly, but it's probably best that they listen in the next 2 weeks. We're going to have a roundtable discussion on the Purpose-Driven Life, which is the book that forms the basis for 40 days of purpose. We'll have a roundtable of pastors talking, Pastor Tom Baker, Pastor Will Whedon, and Dr. Larry Rast from Concordia Theological Seminary, all of whom are diligently reading the book at this time in preparation for that roundtable two-hour discussion on the Purpose-Driven Life, coming up within the next 2 weeks here on Issues Etc. And when the date is firm, we'll be sure to let you know. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Mark is calling from DePere. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. I don't know if anyone mentioned, in terms of fads, perhaps the spiritual gifts inventories.
Oh, yes. It hasn't been mentioned yet, and I'm glad you did, but there was another one. Did you ever have opportunity to fill out one of those little questionnaires, Mark?
Yeah, it seems like it was about 20 years ago. That's when it seemed to be come around where I was.
Yeah, I had too. I remember when, and now I think you probably outdate me a little bit, Mark, but when I was in youth group in high school, we were routinely given these questionnaires, and we were told this was vital for the survival of the congregation. If we didn't fill out these questionnaires and inventory our spiritual gifts, we were really just going to go nowhere, either as individuals in life, as Christians, and that and the congregation would be severely hampered if they didn't have a complete inventory of our spiritual gifts. They kind of went away after about 2 or 3 years. Although I'm given to understand, having finished Warren's book, The 40 Days, I'm sorry, the Purpose-Driven Life, that there in the waning chapters of his book, he does talk about kind of making an inventory of your spiritual gifts. Maybe he'll bring that one back around again for a second go-round. Mark, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
So there's another one to add to the list, spiritual gift inventories. And that was one that really, I mean, it cut across denominational lines, across confessional lines. You had Catholics doing their spiritual gifts inventories. You had Methodists, Baptists, Lutherans, Presbyterians, non-denominational churches doing their spiritual gift inventories. And we were told that this would be the next, this was the next big thing. This was something vital to the survival of the church. This was really something vital to understanding your whole existence as a Christian. You want to know what my experience was? Because I actually filled this thing out in two separate congregations. I filled it out in the congregation I had been raised in, this spiritual gift inventory. And then I went to a different congregation because I became enamored of their contemporary worship. This was in my younger days, obviously. And they had me fill out one, too. I even remember saying, I just filled one out at my old congregation. If you want that one, you know, I can bring it to you. Because it was something of a process. No. You know, we've got our own. So I filled out two of them. And in both cases, upon reflection, and this took some time, well, first of all, it seemed kind of subjective to me. It seemed to be a pretty serious confusion of what I liked with what my gift must be. It really seemed to be more an inventory of my preferences, my likes and dislikes, my inclinations, than any objective question as to what my gifts were. And I remember the list of gifts that were possible were just mind-boggling. There I was in high school, and I might have the gift of administration. My pastor might not. You know, I might be qualified to administer the affairs of the church better than my pastor. There I was in high school. I looked at the list of spiritual gifts, and there they were. You know, we were kind of given the list so that we could get an idea of what they were aiming at. And I remember thinking, well, half of these things, I don't want to do half these things. And being the smart and always being a good taker of tests, I filled out the spiritual gift inventory on two separate occasions, and I came up with the same answers on both occasions. And lo and behold, my gifts were exactly what I wanted to do. The Spirit had given me gifts to do exactly what I wanted to do. And the things that I didn't want to do, the Spirit hadn't given me those gifts. It was amazing. You know what I've discovered since I've grown up and outgrown that particular fad? The gifts that I thought I had, that this inventory indicated I had when I was in high school, I didn't turn out to have those gifts. I wanted them. I thought I was qualified for them. I wasn't. It might surprise you to hear that when I was in high school, I was petrified of speaking in public. I went into college with the same fear, almost a phobia. I remember my college speech class. I had no problem with the speech class as long as we were dealing with theory. Rhetoric and what makes for good diction and all these kind of things. All very interesting. But I knew that at the end of this college speech class, which was a required course, by the way, I was going to have to get up in front of this. And it wasn't a big class. Dozen, maybe a couple dozen kids. And I would have to give a speech. I've undergone medical procedures. I have been stopped by the police on numerous occasions. I've been in danger of all sorts. I've been chased by big dogs. I once, at camp, when they brought out the drug-sniffing dogs to do the little demonstration for the kiddos, I was a counselor. I was actually volunteered against my will to wear the big arm thing and run away from the Doberman pinchers until they tackled me. I know what fear is. compared in no way whatsoever to getting up in front of two dozen college students and giving that first speech. I didn't want to speak in public. And my spiritual gifts inventory, by the way, when I took it in high school, indicated that I didn't have the gift of... Spirit hadn't given me that gift because I didn't want to do it. God has a strange way of delivering his gifts to his people. He doesn't always require that we know what they are, which kind of highlights something about the whole fad in the church. The fad, as it sweeps in and sweeps out, more often a reflection of what we think God should be doing in the church than what God is actually doing. Sometimes, and I think this is the case with our latest fads, more a reflection of what the marketers in and outside the church think will sell to Christians. And when they're done selling, lo and behold, the fad goes away. Because, you know, these products only have a certain shelf life with us. But they're ready with the next one that will be delivered to us with the same hopeful promises that this will be the thing that will bring another reformation in the church. You know, there are things in the church that aren't fads that never go out of style. Well, maybe they go out of the style in the minds of some Christians. The clear preaching of law and gospel. That's gone out of style with some Christians, but in God's book, it never goes out of style. It's the constant exhortation of God's word to deliver the message of repentance and the forgiveness of sins in Jesus' name. That doesn't change. That doesn't fade with the fads. Making disciples by baptizing, teaching these disciples to observe everything I have commanded you, the word of God, the sacraments that deliver the grace of God to us through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, these things never change. Year in, year out, they hang in the closet of the church. Sadly, in some churches, go completely unused, but they are always recommended and commanded by God. And we sometimes lay them aside for the latest fad, thinking that we can do better than what God has delivered to us in his word and sacraments. That's why fads are, by definition, simply our foolishness. God's foolishness is the preaching of the cross. Before we leave, let me remind you one more time today about this private screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners of the Luther movie. It's starting Friday. You will have an opportunity to attend this private screening of the Luther movie Saturday morning, September the 27th at 10 o'clock at the DePere 14 Cinema at 270 in Manchester Road. Have your Visa, your MasterCard, or your Discover card ready and call this number, 725-3030. That's call tomorrow during regular business hours, or 1-800-844-0524 to get a ticket. It's $10 a person, a private screening of the Luther movie. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.